This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Even though you didn't know about his life, you know, obviously the fans didn't realize how much he was struggling until his passing, I think. But you could still feel this connection to like a real person, a real soul, if you will, behind the music.
This week's episode is dedicated to the late, great Tim Bergling, better known to his millions of fans as superstar DJ and producer Avicii. But behind the epic performances, the incredible collaborations with the likes of Chris Martin, was a man dealing with crippling anxiety and addiction issues. Tim was just 28 when he took his own life 4 years ago, and now an official biography, simply called Tim, has been released, with all profits going to the Tim Bergling Foundation, which supports the prevention of mental illness and suicide. Today, the book's author has very kindly joined us to talk more about the book and the brilliant soul who inspired it. Måns Musesson, welcome to Mad World.
Thank you so much. I've been looking forward to this. It's going to be great.
Listen, I've got so much to ask you about. But the first question I ask all of my guests is, how are you really right now? How are you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because now, of course, it's the most beautiful weeks in Stockholm in Sweden. And I can feel in my body that, like last year, I was so deep into this project, into finalizing this book. So now I realize that, you know, I missed out on spring last year completely. So I can feel that sort of relief of actually seeing all this beautiful green stuff that's blooming right now. And that makes me in a great mood, you know. And I was just in Gothenburg, my hometown, visiting my brother this weekend. Yeah, so I feel I'm in a good space.
Måns, you're a journalist. You work for a national newspaper in Sweden.
Right.
This book is, I mean, I'll start by saying personally, as someone who I know, obviously, like everyone, we know Avicii's music, but I knew very little about the house music scene or anything like that. And I'd watched the documentary that was released after his death, but this,
right,
which was very moving and quite disturbing, but this is such a huge picture of the man behind the music, and it's incredibly moving. And I think that the thing about it is that on the one hand, yes, it's a story about the crazy music industry and what happens when you get to that level where, you know, the money almost becomes more important than the human. But on the other right. hand, the whole time I was reading it, so much of it resonated with me, of this like boy who basically got into this thing that he really loved and often wasn't able to be true to himself because of the machinery around it. But there's so much in there that resonates. You don't have to be a sort of, you know, a famous person to kind of to find something in it. I wanted to ask, and I'll sort of get onto that, but how did you end up writing this book?
So, like you said, normally I write for a newspaper, and I wrote a piece about Tim right when he passed, because Stockholm was so affected by it. I mean, Sweden was, of course, and the world was, but you know, you could really sense a difference in the whole city of Stockholm during those very, very sad days when he passed 4 years ago now. But it was also beautiful because, you know, the first thing that happened, really, so he passed on a Friday, and then on the Saturday, on like the main square in the city, thousands of people showed up dancing, you know, to his music, crying and dancing. So I wrote a piece about that, you know, about sort of what he meant, I guess, to our community. And then going forward 1 year, his last album with the tracks that he was recording just days before his passing, that album was released. And so then I flew to Las Palmas to speak to his parents. And I didn't know at that time, you know, how sort of close and involved they had been throughout his whole career. And it was really interesting talking to them about this whole journey through the eyes of being a parent, you know, in all this, with all their concerns that they had had throughout his journey, you know. And we had really, I could sense right away that we had great conversations, candid, open, honest conversations about, you know, addiction, even early on. It was like they had decided already, I think, that if we're going to start to tell his story, we need to do it in a truthful manner, right? You can't just sort of gloss over things, because then it has no real value to it. The worst thing that can happen have already happened to them. And it had been a year, and I think they were already sort of set on this feeling that his story might be helpful for other people, if you tell it in a truthful and sort of respectful manner, you know? Yeah, so I wrote that second piece, and then they asked me to write the book. That's sort of the short story of it. And, you know, I'm really grateful, of course, that they have been so open throughout this process. For instance, like one of the backbones really in this book, I would say, is that I was able to go through Tim's emails, right? It's 40,000 emails from like the very early stumbling steps upon the scene, and then all the way throughout this 10-year plus career, all the way up to his last days, really. And I, you know, his friends have blessed me with text messages and pictures, so I'm able to see things through Tim's eyes quite much. At least I hope so, you know, to understand this crazy jumble of events that a super career like this is through his perspective. Yeah, but that's the short backstory, I would say.
But it is crazy, like, because what I didn't know, which I didn't sort of, was that Tim was essentially a teenage boy who was kind of anxious, very anxious a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And he spent most of his time sitting in his bedroom playing World of Warcraft with his mates, right?
Right, yeah.
And what I had no idea was that he'd sort of stumbled across this music program that other people were, like, using on computers. And thought, well, I'll have a go at that, you know, because he's a techie genius. And from that, it's not that much of a leap until he's sort of being called over to Ibiza and playing in clubs. I mean, it's crazy, right?
He was so stubborn and sort of strong-willed, and, you know, he mastered so back when they were playing video games, him and his friends. Because that's that's the kind of guy he is. He's sort of an introvert, geeky kind of guy who loved just spending time in his, you know, bedroom, basically. And he took all his friends there rather than going out on town. And, you know, while they were going to sleep on these World of Warcraft raids, he just stayed up all night just really trying to understand all the tricks and sort of master the game. And I would say that when he first started doing music, that was a perfect fit for him, because I think he, at least in the beginning, he thought about it almost mathematically, to sort of master and break this program, if you know what I mean, to the FL Studio, which is the software. I think that was like really what was so fun to him, was to sort of get behind the program, if that makes sense. And I think that makes it, that's why it's not, it all connects in a way, you know. He made music in the same stubborn way that he would play video games. I don't know if I'm making sense right now, but do you know what I mean?
No, you are. And what I, you know, love is that he saw that someone had made some record through this program that had had millions of streams or whatever. I'm sounding like an old lady now with my terminology. And he was like...
That was Bass Hunter. He was pretty big in the UK as well.
Bass Hunter, yeah. He's like an old... Bass Hunter, that novelty record he did. And he thought, I'll have a go at this. And, you know, thank God he did think that. The music that he created, you know, it was, you mentioned about the day after he died and people just playing his music in a square in Stockholm. And his music was all about connection, wasn't it? It was all about connection with something bigger, like I guess a sort of higher power almost, you know. And yet behind this was this, you know, quite lonely young man who he was... You know, this isn't a morality tale about fame and fortune because he wasn't in it for that, was he? He was in it because he loved making the music and he was bloody good at it.
No, that's exactly right. And I think that's why, you know, he had this sensibility that is quite rare. And especially, I would say, in this genre at this time, which was, you know, it was really blaring music. A lot of times, you know, and Tim, as a listener, you could sense in all his tracks that here is a person speaking to me sort of behind the bass line, behind the drums, which made you, even though you didn't sort of know about his life, cause, you know, obviously the fans didn't realize how much he was struggling. A lot of them, you know, didn't really know that until his passing, I think. But you could still feel this connection to like a real person, a real soul, if you will, behind the music. And it made you sort of care for that someone. You can sort of sense Tim's vulnerability in his tracks. As, you know, euphoric as they are, there's still this very special sensibility to them.
He started out, he was very anti-drugs. Like he wasn't interested in them. He'd had a bad experience with some dope or something.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, again, it's this tragic thing. He had bad acne, didn't he, as a teenager? And he started taking this medication that cleared it up and suddenly he had confidence and he could approach girls. But there's this heart-rending bit where he ends up hospitalized with pancreatitis in the book and in his life, which is in part caused by the acne medication, but also by just the exhaustion and the intensity of this world he's found himself in. He's touring, he's traveling, he doesn't know what city he's in. And he says, you know, obviously you've got access to all of these text messages and emails, and he says those days in hospital were the most anxiety and stress-free days I can remember the past 6 years. Those were my true vacations, as depressing as it might sound. And there's that sort of, you know, even though you know how this story ends and you know how this book ends, the whole way through I was wanting to reach into the pages and give him a hug and say, you know, how did no one see? But of course they did. And it's just, as you make the point so often, so beautifully in this book, that it's so complex and it's so much more nuanced than that. And there was so much other stuff going on.
Yeah, I think that was one of my actually first real revelations. It came quite early on in this process. I think that I had the idea, as I'm sure that a lot of fans have had the idea, that Tim was this sort of well-off, happy-go-lucky kind of guy who was just thrusted into a mad, evil industry that sort of kills people. And you know, there are some truth to that, of course. Once you go to his level, it's really insane how much the workload for him was unbearable. And it is a dirty industry in a lot of ways. But, you know, as soon as I started to talk to childhood friends, to his parents, it became clear quite quickly that, you know, it's not only that, because this is also a guy that had been struggling with anxiety and, you know, could have a hard time just going on like a social function among his own friends, you know.
He first had therapy when he was 14.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So for me, I feel that that is an important part to sort of nuance that image a little bit, because I also feel that that makes him more of a human being, you know. He's like a real person. He's not someone who's always been this brand, this Avicii brand. He's Tim Bergling, you know. And I think that I'm glad you made that point earlier, that you can identify with some of the things he went through, because I've really tried to make, you know, I really hope that the reader will be able to sort of reflect on their own behaviors and their own lives while reading this. And things like this, you know, it is complex. It's always nuanced, especially when you get to know someone the way that I feel that I know Tim now. I would make him a disservice, I think, if I didn't sort of paint this in... There are some, you know, gray... What's that word in English?
Gray
things
areas.
Are complicated.
Yeah, gray areas. It's not just black and white. I think also exactly. What really comes across in the book, which I think is anyone can relate to, is the sense of going into something that you think you want to do, but being caught in what you kind of feel everyone's expecting you to do.
Yep.
And I know it sounds corny, but it's that thing of not being able to be true to yourself and how actually critical that is to our well-being. And he gets stuck, and how easily it is to get caught in this cycle of trying to kind of just reach everyone else's expectations of you.
Yeah.
And, you know, after the pancreatitis, he is, you know, he becomes addicted, essentially. I mean, this book touches on so many things, the opioid crisis, you know, you talk about Purdue Pharma, but he essentially becomes addicted to painkillers, and he's essentially taking pills to numb the pain, taking pills to wake him up, taking pills to put him to bed, you know, and it's like he's just in this cycle that is very difficult to get out of.
And, you know, he, especially during the first years, really, of his career, he wasn't easy to just sort of push. He wasn't someone that was just pushed around, which I also think is sort of a misconception about him. He was super stoked about his career, and he wanted his name written in the sky, you know. He was so committed to his music, and so for a long time he had a hard time, you know, accepting the help that was offered to him. You know, when people were reaching out and feeling worried that he worked too much, he took too many pills, he had a way, which I think is super common, by the way, to push all those, everything he sort of deemed as a negative emotion or anything that sort of hindered his career, he just pushed that aside. And he actually, can I read you just a piece where he writes about that himself?
Yes, I'd love that.
Yeah. Because, you know, because I was so happy when I found out, you know, all the things that he himself had wrote about these type of issues, you know, reflecting. Because, you know, down the line, he, and I'm sure we'll touch on this, but, you know, he ends up at this rehab clinic in Ibiza, where he starts to write about sort of his journey there. And this is just a small little piece from that, where he's saying, my procrastination, it needed to be explained to me very logically and caveman-esque for me to truly understand its nature and how it was harming me. Ouch, pain. Why me pain now? Uncomfortable feeling. Future Tim, deal with pain. future Tim deal with pain better than present Tim, because already there's too many present pains more urgent to deal with. I think it's beautiful to sort of get this in his own words. And again, I for certain can sort of relate to that. It's not only other expectations, it's the expectations that you have on yourself as well, you know? And so everything that sort of is in its way, we have to take that some other day, because now I just need to reach this next, you know, goal of mine. And for him, he had 10, 15, 20 things like this to do in a day, you know, prepare new sets and make new tracks and be part of some commercial. And my point is that it really took him a while to sort of understand how destructive that habit is.
I mean, it's a lifetime's work, isn't it? I think that bit, I'm glad you read that bit out, because I had referenced it. That is, I mean, just personally, I you know, I'm in recovery from addiction, and that really resonated, that thing of like, you put it off to another time because it's almost like the pain is too great now. You don't think about the pain in the future. It's like, you just need to get through. And there was
and that's the thing with painkillers. You know, it's not only, of course, they are crazily addictive in how they affect the brain and the body, but it's also a mental addiction. You know, the fact that they do work in the sense that they do give you that period of relief from all the things that are really hard to cope with right now, you know?
Well, they work until they stop working, don't they? I think that's the thing that people forget, is that these are for a while, they're solutions.
Yeah.
And then there's often an assumption that once you stop taking them, or you get yourself off the thing that you've been addicted to, that life is suddenly rosy. But of course, that's not the case, because life is still throwing at you all the things it was throwing at you before. But this time, you know, you don't have anything to buffer you from it, which is where the chapters about his time in this rehab were really, and how he goes in there and he's doing it like a lot of people, I think, who turn up in rehab. He's doing it for other people. He's like, I'll just do this to shut them up. And then by the end of it, he's had this quite transformative experience, right?
Yeah, a true turning point, that is. It's just a couple of months, really, but it changed his perception on so many things, you know, and, you know, especially his own sort of thinking. This is, you know, just by the way, this is such a beautiful place, you know. You go into the pine forest and become really sort of hidden from other world, you know, and everybody turn off their cell phones, and finally no more inboxes screaming at you, you know. So, you know, the first thing, apart from, you know, weaning off the drugs, was that he was actually able to sleep, you know. And then he was sitting up in the rooftop, on the roof of the clinic, and then by night he would make excursions out into the forest, you know, where all these wild rabbits are running around, you know. And for the first time in a long while, he sort of connected with his environment, you know, if that makes sense. And he started to read up on books that was there at the clinic. And one thing that really resonated with him was, you know, mindfulness. And Tim is a big reader, by the way. People might not think that, you know, because this genre is not sort of something that we connect to reading, but he had always been a great reader. And so then when he started to read up on mindfulness and realized, you know, how old those thoughts are, going back to Buddhism, really, you know, that was a big revelation for him. This fact that, you know, you can, in meditation, observe your emotions and feelings and not be so harsh to them. You know, just listen to them, just see them and acknowledge that they are there, you know, and not be pissed that they are there. That was sort of groundbreaking for him, I would say. Very eye-opening. So as strange as that may sound, you know, there are at least parts of this journey that to me are really positive.
Oh my God, I was just going to say to you, like, there is so much hope in this book, which, as you say, sounds impossible. This book came to my attention because I have a friend who works in the record industry, and he passed it to me. I think he must have got a proof copy, and he said, yep, you have to read this book. This is an amazing book about mental health, but also about the record industry. It's fantastic. And as I was reading it, I had this sense of I felt real hope. You know, he starts reading Eckhart Tolle. He starts reading, and I thought, and I felt, you know, and I think this is something that a lot of readers have found of it. You know, you go on this journey and you feel, and I started ordering all the books that he was reading in rehab, right, all of your further reading in it. I was like, because it is, you know, if there's anything we can learn from this book is that Tim was on, you know, he was on a beautiful path, you know, of, yeah, self-discovery. And I, that's kind of what I want to focus on, because I think that, and this is also a real misconception about suicide, is we have this idea of suicidal people as that you'll be able to see it, you'll be able to know it. And yet we know again and again, people say they never saw it coming. And there's, so obviously it's all a tragedy, but in the months leading up to his death, he seemed to have found some sort of equilibrium, right? He was going to move back to Sweden from LA. He was meditating. And there's this bit of which I've written down. After his death, where his father, Klaus, is in LA clearing out his studio. And you write, he had walked next to his son all those years, seen Tim feel bad. So why had he never realised the full extent of the problem? That it would end this way had never crossed Klaus's mind, not even in his worst nightmares, least of all when their son had been in the middle of his most creative flow in many years. The only thing his parents had heard from Tim in the days before he died was how fantastic the songs were, how beautiful it was in the desert, how much he was looking forward to travelling to Iceland with his siblings. Klaus had also talked to the therapist in Stockholm. This is who his mother Anki spoke to. She had called suicide a serial crash of the mind, a few days of anguish and anxiety that had thrown Tim back to a place that those around him thought he had left behind. That to me was such a powerful, powerful couple of paragraphs about what suicidal thoughts are and how out of the blue they can come.
Yeah, thank you. I really wanted to sort of discuss the mechanisms behind suicidal thoughts here. And I'm really glad, you know, by the way, that there are so many friends of his that I've spoke to that share their own experiences dealing with these kind of issues, like panic attacks and addiction, but also suicidal thoughts, and how really hard they can hit you in a very short period of time. You know, that it really is an emergency, a crisis that, you know, can just engulf you and sort of shift all the perspectives, right? Some people describe it as this tunnel, that you're sort of trapped. You're entrapped in this tunnel that is sort of slowly closing in on you. Meaning that when you're in that crisis, you can't see the solutions. You really are that affected by it, that there is no future all of a sudden, you know? And you can come past that. But it's not, I'm saying it, it makes it sound easy to just sort of realize this and have the tools. Of course, it's not that easy. But it's super sad, the fact that he really was, creatively, he was in his flow again, you know. He was so happy and proud about the last tracks that he recorded. Yeah, I don't, you know, it's just sad.
And also, I think what for me is so powerful about this book is that obviously the Tim Bergling Foundation is there for suicide and mental illness prevention. But I think often when we talk about suicide prevention, it can be very painful for those left behind who, yep, have experienced, who have been bereaved by suicide, because, you know, I have a friend who's just experienced it in her family, and, you know, it's that sense of, well, what could I have done? What could I have done to make it, you know, stop, or to have changed it, or to have helped this person? And actually, I think it's really important to know that it isn't, you know, there is often nothing we can do. Sadly, for some people, it is just as cancer can kill some people. You know, mental illness does unfortunately lead to this, which is not a very articulate way of putting it. But I think what I found really helpful about this is that the way that this will help to prevent it in the future is that reading that suicide is a serial crash of the mind.
Yeah.
Right. And that it can pass. And just as suddenly as it can come on you, it can go again, you know?
Exactly that. Yep.
And I think that is a really powerful thing for all humans to know, because it gives you, even if when you're in those crashing thoughts, if you have that slight knowledge at the back of your head that it might pass tomorrow, not today, just stay today, just stay this hour. That's the power. And that's where the prevention comes in, if that makes sense.
No, yeah. Amen. Yeah, you're right.
It's honestly, it's such an astonishing book. And I felt this sadness that I hadn't, like, I think I was too old, really, to get into Avicii's right. music. But I now want to go and devour all of his music. And I want to know about the Tim Bergling Foundation. Can you tell me a bit about that and the work it does?
Yeah, sure.
And how his parents are doing?
It's never too late to discover him, by the way, musically. You really should.
I think I know more of his songs than I thought I didn't know them, but of course I do, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not going to sing Wake Me Up because nobody needs to hear my rendition of that. But
no, but it's also, you know, again, I feel that I know the guy right now. But I don't think you have to do that to get very touched by his music. He really had a special kind of touch. So, you know, I would just urge everybody who, because he was put in, and that was a thing that he sort of had a hard time dealing with at times, that he was, you know, labeled as a part of this EDM movement, which made sense, of course, because he was in the forefront of that. But he also had this feeling of, sometimes people can't see that I'm making real music here. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, they don't see how much work I put in to really make this music as emotional as it can be, you know. Anyway, that's a side note. Yeah, the foundation is really a beautiful thing. They had just set it up when I started to talk to the parents, and in a way, of course, this, and they, you know, this, that's not a controversial statement, because they are saying it themselves, that, you know, in a way, of course, it's a part of their grieving process to set up this foundation that, in different ways, what they do is they fund and help other organizations that have way more experience in suicide prevention and mental health issues. But what I think is beautiful about it is that Klaus and Anki, Tim's parents, so early on decided that, you know, the worst thing that can happen to a parent have already happened to us. It can't be undone, you know. It's just, Tim is gone. But they recognize how much power his name has, of course, you know, and how deeply affected the fans are by his story, because they, as soon as Tim passed, they just were overflooded by emails and letters and flowers and, like, real profound stories that the listeners wanted to share with them. There is a certain connection between the listeners and a guy like this, you know, and they recognize that they can do something with that. So, like, one of the things that they have done so far, just to give you, you know, one example, is that they have funded so that one of the main suicide helplines here in Sweden can be open 24/7, mm-hmm. in a way that it wasn't before. So they try to find really hands-on ways of helping other organizations deal with these type of issues.
Mons, thank you so much for coming and sharing Tim's story with us today. And I feel a bit weird saying it's a fantastic book, because obviously it's born out of such tragedy, but thank you for telling his story. And please thank Klaas and Anki for, you know, for their generosity in allowing this to be told, you know, because they didn't have to do that. Thank you so much. Send them send them our love. And Tim, the official biography. That's how I'll always think of him, as Tim, not Avicii.
Right. Yeah. I like that. And I'll be sure to give them a hug.
Please.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate any chance of not only discussing the book, but, you know, discussing these broader topics. I really feel it's important that we have a real conversation about this. So thank you.
Before you go, please follow Mad World on your podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you feel like it, leave us a rating and a review. I love to read what you think about the shows and also see your guest suggestions. Mad World is all about helping our listeners, and I love hearing from you. The Telegraph also let me loose in column form, so if you'd like to hear even more from me, head to telegraph.co.uk/madworld and you can get your first 30 days access to the website completely free. If you've been affected by anything we've talked about in our podcast today, the following organisations offer free and confidential support over the phone. The Samaritans can be reached 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on 116 123. Or you can contact the mental health charity Mind for advice on a range of mental health issues. Their phone number is 0300 123 3393. That's 0300 123 3393. They're accessible 9 a.m. to 5 p.m, Monday to Friday, excluding bank holidays. There's also Young Minds, who provide support if you're a parent or a carer worried about a child's welfare. They're on 0808 802 5544. That's 0808 802 5544. If you prefer tech support, Shout is a 24/7 UK crisis text service available for times when people feel they need immediate support. By texting Shout to 85258, you will be put in touch with a trained crisis volunteer who will chat to you via text. And importantly, please remember this: you are not alone.